Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling 823-1501, State of Minnesota versus Lou Vang.
Good morning. We're now moving on to our second scheduled case for oral argument this morning. And just a reminder that you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's a timer on the central podium that will reset according to the time you have for your argument. I'd ask you each to introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument and identify your client for the purposes of our recording. And let us know if there's a particular pronunciation or a way you'd like us to refer to you or your client. Additionally, I will note that the podium does move down if you need to lower it at all or adjust it. And with that, there are 15 minutes on the clock, and counsel for appellant, you may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Emma Ritter-Gordon from Lockridge Grindle-Nowen, appearing today as a Special Assistant State Public Defender on behalf of Mr. Lou Vang. When St. Paul police stopped Mr. Vang in 2020, they violated his rights under the Fourth Amendment in Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Constitution, not once, but twice. The first violation occurred at the outset when officers Becerra and Polk conducted a traffic stop without reasonable suspicion that Mr. Vang had violated a traffic law. The second violation occurred soon after, when Officer Becerra reached his hand into the car to grab Mr. Vang's wallet without probable cause. Both violations provide this court with an independent basis to reverse Mr. Vang's conviction and order the evidence suppressed. Let me start with the vehicle search. Here's what's not in dispute. One, the vehicle search began when Officer Becerra reached into the car to grab Mr. Vang's wallet. Two, at that point, Officer Becerra only knew three things. He smelled marijuana, he saw a digital scale, and he noticed nervousness. Three, the district court relied on the odor of marijuana alone for its probable cause finding. In light of those three things, under State v. Torgerson, this court should reverse. Torgerson clarified that the odor of marijuana alone is not sufficient for probable cause to search a vehicle. So that holding was error. The district court did cite two alternative reasons that it said supported probable cause, the digital scale and the nervousness. But that is not enough either. Torgerson instructs us to consider the possibility of innocent justifications based on legal marijuana use. And here, three factors are consistent with just that. As we know from Torgerson, the smell of marijuana is consistent with legal use. Nervousness is a natural reaction to a traffic stop, as State v. Smith recognizes. And a digital scale can be used for legal as well as illegal marijuana use. So given those...
The district court found that the totality of the circumstances were the standard that they used in finding probable cause, correct?
They did use the totality of the circumstances test, but they cited those three circumstances as those present when the search occurred.
So how is that an abuse of discretion by the district court?
This standard review is actually de novo, so this court is reviewing the evidence and making that legal decision on its own.
What are we to make of the fact that the scale, the digital scale, it wasn't just that it was sitting in the vehicle, it was that it was tucked underneath of his leg?
I think it is important to consider innocent explanations. That's in State v. Robinson, which we cited in our brief, and how easily it can be mistaken, an innocent gesture for something suspicious. That's in State v. Gallagher. And really, the digital scale is consistent with legal use. And so that gets under Torgerson to the weight of that factor because it is consistent with legal marijuana use. So even if the digital scale was between his legs, it doesn't actually get us any closer to probable cause.
Do you disagree that it's a reasonable inference that perhaps he was trying to hide the scale?
I think State v. Robinson and Gallagher both counsel that this court should also consider innocent explanations, such as it fell between his legs, he was reaching for his wallet, and it got shoved in. So that is our position on the position of the digital scale.
And even if we do that, we have to take it in consideration with the other two factors that you mentioned, the scent of the marijuana as well as the nervous behavior, right?
Correct. Here it's helpful, I think, to look at State v. Lindekugel. That case had far more factors present in the probable cause analysis. There was a truck straddling two parking lanes. It was after bar close in a high crime area. The officer saw a short glass or plastic thing, which appeared to be a smoking device. The defendant had slow and slurred speech. There were plastic baggies on the floor with marijuana in one. Those are far more factors than we have here. Another case that I think is helpful is State v. Burbach. In that case, there was the odor of marijuana and nervousness, and that was not enough even for reasonable suspicion. Torgerson discusses that in the case itself and counsels that that's helpful for the probable cause analysis well. So really what we're dealing with is just that digital scale and whether it gets us across the threshold to probable cause, given that it's consistent with legal marijuana use. Under Torgerson, it doesn't get us there.
Well, not that alone, but there are other things here. There's a digital scale, and the standard is whether it will, there's probable cause to, that the search will produce evidence that a crime has been committed, correct?
The totality of the circumstances does tell us to consider everything, but if you have the smell of marijuana, which has little weight under Torgerson, nervousness, which has little weight, and a digital scale, which has little weight, you can't add 0 + 0 + 0 to get probable cause.
Or 1 + 1 = 1 = 3.
Well, we disagree that it's 1. We say it's 0 under Torgerson because it is consistent with legal marijuana
use. I don't think you can separate the 3 out and say that's none and that's none and that's none when you have a total situation. How do you negate each separate thing and say that isn't anything and that isn't anything and that isn't anything? But you look at the totality to figure out, is it probable that a crime has been committed?
I disagree. In Torgerson, it discusses the Colorado Supreme Court case People v. Zuniga. That's at 995 Northwest 2nd at 174, where that discussion occurs. And the Colorado Supreme Court, which the Minnesota Supreme Court said that the analysis was persuasive and in line with Minnesota precedent, it explains that the possibility of an innocent justification merely affects a fact's weight and persuasiveness, which does get to the fact that although it is a totality of the circumstances test, there is consideration of each factor separately. I think the analysis in Torgerson helps for another reason, which is that the Torgerson court specifically noted that there was no evidence that the use was not for legal medicinal purposes. We have nothing in the record here either about that. And so, again, that's something that this court needs to consider in making its decision.
Is it correct that in Torgerson, the only circumstance that was present was the scent of marijuana? So the court there wasn't evaluating a situation where there were additional circumstances to consider.
That is correct based on my recollection, but I think, again, State v. Lindekugel gives us another example where there are far more factors than here. So I really would set this up as, are we closer to Torgerson or closer to Lindekugel? Where does that line fall? This court doesn't need to draw that line, but it is closer to Torgerson, given that nervousness has little probative value in the probable cause analysis and that digital scale is consistent with legal marijuana use. I also want to address quickly the other factors that the state brought up at the very end of its brief. That's a tacit admission that the factors the district court considered are not enough for probable cause, the fact that those were brought up at all. And the state cites to neither case law nor even the record in bringing up those additional factors. even if this court does consider them, they add little to the probable cause analysis. One of the factors the state cites is the movements that it says are furtive in the back seat. The record shows Mr. Vang and his passenger were trying to find his phone to find his insurance information. That's likely what the movements were caused by, and you can see that in the body cam footage by Officer Becerra when they're looking around for that insurance information. The state also cites heavy breathing and shaking. That really collapses into the nervousness analysis in State v. Grissom.
Perhaps I'm wrong, but I thought that the furtive movements that were being referred to were after the officers turned their lights on to indicate they were making the stop, not at the point when they were actually asking for the insurance.
I'm not sure because the record site wasn't there.
Okay.
I would say, though, that it's well known that traffic stops require insurance, and I think it would be natural to start looking for the insurance once that light behind you goes on in preparation to interact with law enforcement officers. The final additional factor that the state brings up is the bubble. That was found after the search began, so it cannot contribute to probable cause.
You would agree, though, that under the point you made that we're conducting a de novo review here, that we would be able to consider those things if we agree that they add to the totality of the circumstances?
The record wasn't fully developed, at least on the furtive movements. Again, that wasn't in the hearing, and this court would not have a full record to make that factual determination on. I think the heavy breathing and shaking really collapses into nervousness, so I think it adds little. And the bubble can't be considered because the search began as soon as he reached his hand into the car. State v. Stevenson supports that. The Lefebvre search and seizure treatise supports that. So the bubble is out entirely. That issue is dispositive. There's another path for this court to reach the same conclusion, and that's the traffic stop, which had no reasonable suspicion to support it. The dash cam footage makes clear, if you watch Exhibit 73 from 7 seconds in to 12 seconds in, that it's impossible to see Mr. Vang's car behind a line of vehicles for the entire 100 feet before the turn.
So but the testimony of the officers was that both Officer Becerra said that you can observe more from his vantage point than you could see from the dash cam or the body cam. And in addition, Officer Polk testified that at the angle he was sitting, he could in fact see.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, Officer Polk testified that he did not tell Officer Becerra to make the stop. That's the August 3rd hearing, page 23, lines 15 to 17. He answered correct as well to the question that it was Officer Becerra who turned left to follow the vehicle and activated the overhead lights. So Officer Polk's observations didn't contribute to the stop based on his own testimony.
Second, are we allowed to attribute the knowledge of the officers collectively to each of them?
When it's based on a visual line of sight, if Officer Polk does not articulate to Officer Becerra what he sees, that can't contribute to Officer Becerra's reasonable suspicion to initiate the stop. Officer Becerra, in the March 30th hearing, this is on page 36 to the top of page 37, he was asked point blank whether it was his testimony that he could see the right turn indicator of the motor vehicle prior to that right turn indicator coming into view of the camera, and he did not say yes. He merely said he noticed that the indicator as he was already making the turn. So we don't have clear testimony from Officer Becerra that he could see it, and he did agree that the dash cam is to the right of his line of sight. So trying to find the right-hand turn signal of an oncoming car, the dash cam would logically have a better view than Officer Becerra. And the mistake of fact must be judged by the objective standards of the facts, not the officer's subjective assessment, that's State v. Ehrke. And the dash cam footage is clear. The district court, of course, also mentioned the window tint as reasonable suspicion, grounds for reasonable suspicion. That's a post hoc justification. They never mentioned the tint until 30 minutes into the stop. So that must be rejected as well.
Well, actually, I think I do have a question here on this. In terms of the window tint, there's some dispute between both sides about whether or not the word tint was used in the video. And in terms of the testimony and the findings of fact that the district court made, it seems to me that that's a credibility determination as to whether or not that was articulated at that time. And don't we have to defer to the district court's credibility determinations?
I'm right at the end of my time, but I'll answer your question. The district court did not make an explicit credibility finding. It's implicit, I suppose, given that it's in the record. But given the clear contradiction by the footage, which doesn't show tint was said, we think under State v. Yerkes that doesn't get us to reasonable suspicion either.
Okay.
Clear error. Thank you.
All right, and we'll turn to counsel for respondent for your principal argument. 15 minutes are on the clock. Please remember to introduce yourself and the party that you represent here today. You may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota in this matter. The two legal issues before the court today received de novo review. However, appellant is asking this court to find that the district court clearly erred in its factual findings and credibility determinations. The clearly erroneous standard is a very high bar, and on this record, appellant has not met its burden. Appellant must attack the district court's findings of fact, though, because it is the only way that appellant can prevail on both of these issues. The only way to prevail is for the appellant to convince this court to disregard the district court's findings of fact and credibility determinations. I'll start where appellant left off with the initial traffic stop. The fundamental question here was the stop a product of mere whim or idle curiosity? And the answer here is clearly no. There were two independent bases for the officers to conduct this stop, and they articulated specific and articulable facts to warrant the stop. The first is the window tint violation. The officer's testimony is clear that as appellant's vehicle was turning in front of them, they noticed that the windows were dark, and they suspected that it was in violation of the law.
They didn't say it was a violation. They just said they noticed it was dark, right?
Correct, yes. They also testified to their training and experience with the window tint law and knowing what percentage of tint was lawful or not. And as the district court found, the window tint, the suspicion of a window tint violation alone establishes a reasonable suspicion to conduct the initial traffic stop. The assertion that this was a post hoc justification actually was not raised to the district court. That was not argued to the district court, and so that's, I think, part of why the district court did not address clearly a credibility determination about the officer's testimony. But regardless, on this record, the officer's testimony under oath clearly says that they noticed the window tint before they initiated the traffic stop. So that alone justifies the stop. And then I want to be clear, moving to the search of the vehicle, that the three circumstances relied on by the district court and found by the district court are sufficient to establish probable cause to search the vehicle under the automobile exception. That is the odor of marijuana, appellant's nervousness, and the officer's observation of the scale that was tucked up under the appellant's lap in the driver's seat of a vehicle while he's driving.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that each of those items individually would not get you to probable cause here?
I agree that under Torgerson, odor of marijuana alone is insufficient. I think also we would have a hard time. Nervousness alone often is not enough in front of the courts. The digital scale as well, although, you know, it's a common household item, it may have innocent explanations, but it's also surely raises questions when it's tucked up under the driver's, in the driver's seat under his legs.
So are we allowed to look at whether the sum is greater than the parts?
For sure, yes, Your Honor. Under the totality of the circumstances review, the state does not need to show that one circumstance alone is enough. You look at all the circumstances together, along with the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from those circumstances, and giving due weight to the officer's training and experience in making those inferences, and due weight to the district court's findings of fact on those circumstances. And so here, I want to make very clear that the state's position is those three circumstances alone in totality meet the automobile exception to the warrant requirement. I believe appellant misreads Torgerson in a couple different ways, but one that was talked about when opposing counsel was arguing is the fact that there could be possible innocent explanations for each of these circumstances. Torgerson doesn't say that then we must negate those circumstances. Just because there are reasonable or innocent explanations when there could also be criminal explanations does not mean that they become zero. It means that you can look at them in totality, in context, and the probable cause analysis is a common sense, non-technical evaluation of the facts. And so unless the court has any additional questions, I believe I've touched upon the main points that I wanted to make. If there are no additional questions, I'll rely on my briefing. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, with that then, we'll return to counsel for appellant for 5 minutes of rebuttal. There are 5 minutes on the clock, and you may begin when you are ready.
Emma Ritter-Gordon on behalf of Mr. Vang. First, I wanted to clarify I did misspeak on State v. Burbach. That case involved alcohol, not marijuana, so I wanted to clarify that. In response to opposing counsel's framing of this as a factual question, that's incorrect. This court needs to make a purely legal decision based on Torgerson whether the factors present at the time of the search are legally enough under that test. The state's view would gut Torgerson. You have the smell of marijuana here, nervousness, and a digital scale. If you follow the state's view, then any traffic stop that has the smell of marijuana, a nervous driver, and anything consistent with legal marijuana use, you get probable cause. And that's not what Torgerson held. You don't need to negate each factor because there's an innocent explanation, but you do need to consider that innocent explanation and it affects the weight of that factor. Torgerson is clear on that point. In terms of officer training and experience, the only point that should go to is the smell of marijuana. On the March 30th hearing on page 36, lines 4-8, Officer Becerra testified he knew he would search the vehicle as soon as he started speaking with Mr. Vang because he smelled the odor of marijuana. So it really was the odor of marijuana that provided the impetus for the search and was the primary reason that Officer Becerra said he decided to search the car.
Wouldn't we also consider their training in terms of identifying that the tint was not a legal tent?
Yes, but in this case, given that the officers didn't bring up the tent until 30 minutes in, the training doesn't get to the fact of whether they saw the tent before or after they decided to stop the car.
I thought the testimony was that they had, that that's what caused them to notice the car initially was the tint. Is that not accurate?
I don't recall that specific exchange in the record. What I do know is that the dash cam footage and the body cam footage doesn't have any mention of tint until 30 minutes into the stop. Now, we don't have the full body cam or dash cam audio as they're watching the cars turn, but that's what we do know. We recognize that the clear error standard is high for us. I think the easiest path for this court to reverse is the Torgerson path, and that's a clear, purely legal issue that under Torgerson, this court should reverse and reverse Mr. Vang's conviction and order the evidence suppressed. If there are no further questions. We will rest on our briefs at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent briefing and for the argument here today. It's been very helpful. The case is submitted. We will take it under consideration, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you.